A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hello, Herman and Corn. I said we'd reach the end of our series of episodes about industrial markers, and I lied. Guess where I find myself on the ground using my new Edding 750 industrial paint marker. Actually, this one isn't from their true industrial line. Although, if you go on their website, you do see a delightful photograph of a man applying this to a jet engine. So that, you know, there's nothing like that to instill confidence in a marker. But we talked about in our several forays into the colourful world of markers, and who knew marking is such a, and adhesive science is such a rich tapestry of information. We mentioned xylene markers, and I mentioned that I was kind of on my current organisation kick. I was very excited because everything you read says xylene free, xylene free. And here's the rub. The people that actually have xylene in their markers don't even put it on the bottle because everyone is saying xylene free. So their silence sometimes, this is the pro tip if you're looking for it, is that it's not on the label. I mentioned that during some of my summers in school, I was helping out my mum owned a picture frame shop and factory, and we used markers a ton, probably the industrial grade. And yesterday when I discovered I had a xylene marker, I instantly got that strong. It's a kind of overpowering, slightly not, like it just does not feel healthy. We talked about xylene before and the reason why it's being phased out because it's a recognized neurotoxin, which sounds kind of as bad as it is basically. It's probably not so bad if you're just using a xylene marker now and again, but you have to think about the poor folks who are in factories, maybe under horrible labor conditions and forced to manufacture these for hours a day. That's the type of industrial exposure that really, really is a risk. So I definitely support these efforts, and my xylene marker will be probably not replenished after this, because this Edding 750, it's a lacquer based marker and it looks to be doing a decent job on plastics, which is the only thing I needed xylene for. But Herman and Corin, rather than continue to talk about industrial solvents, I thought this would actually be a good segue to talk about one of those things that none of us really want to know, think too much about when we're talking about, I mean, we've done episodes about VHB tape, 3M products, all this category of industrial chemicals has a very checkered and coloured history, both in terms of the, I remember there was a great Netflix documentary about some of the effects happening around factories, elevated rates of cancer in the communities that surrounded them. And, you know, there's probably a huge amount of things that are potentially carcinogenic or have been recognised, ranging from food preservatives through to lots of things that have nothing to do with markings. And as much as paint markers is a very niche topic that we found ourselves wading into, the question of what's actually used to paint on surfaces, whether it's you know, a kind of veneer or anything else that we come into contact with every day, it's absolutely everywhere. Paint, anodized, metalled, that kind of thing. I'd love to talk about where industrial solvent regulation is today. I've noticed I've become a big fan of these Edding markers, and I was so interested that I looked up their catalog. And it's for those who appreciate a well laid out technical document or a good catalog, download the Edding catalog. It's a 240 page delight for those who love markers. And what you'll notice is that they're making a huge push towards sustainability across their product lines, phasing out. I think they only make one marker with xylene now, and even their industrial line is moving very much in the direction of ecologically sound materials for the chemistry. Herman and Corin, this is probably not as niche a topic as it may sound to those who have yet to join me down the industrial paint marker rabbit hole. You're always welcome if you do want to make that foray. Start with Herman and Corin's episode about how to get permanent markers to actually be permanent, because it's a great overview of, basically, it all comes down to chemistry. And it's interesting. Let's talk today, Herman and Corin, about solvent regulation, adhesive regulation, and where we're moving in 2026.
Daniel's back with another marker prompt, and I have to say, the man said he was done with industrial markers. He lied, and honestly, I respect the commitment to the bit. He's on the floor of his place in Jerusalem labeling plastic storage bins with an Edding 750 paint marker, the same marker their website shows a man applying to a jet engine to Tupperware, that's range.
Here's the thing that grabbed me about what he said. He noticed that the xylene markers don't actually say they contain xylene on the bottle anymore. The silence on the label is the tell, which is a perfect little microcosm of where we are in industrial solvent regulation right now. The thing you're not being told is often the thing that matters most.
Because May 2026 is actually the moment the EU's final REACH restrictions on xylene in consumer products hit full effect. OSHA's expected to follow with their own tightening by Q3. So the marker aisle at the hardware store, which looks boring, which looks like the most mundane shelf in the building, is actually a front line in a quiet chemical revolution that's been building for 40 years.
The Edding 750 he's holding is a lacquer-based marker. Ethyl acetate, butyl acetate, some toluene substitute chemistry, no xylene, but it still manages to bite into plastics the way the old solvent markers did. And Edding's not alone. The whole industry is pivoting, and the pivot is happening fast, and most people have no idea it's even underway.
The question sitting inside Daniel's prompt is bigger than markers. It's what's actually in the stuff we use to paint on surfaces, stick things together, coat things, and who's making sure it won't kill us?
The answer, as we're going to find out, is a lot more complicated than a xylene-free sticker would have you believe.
Which brings us to the obvious question. Why xylene in the first place? It's not like someone at a marker company in 1962 just picked it out of a hat.
No, it was chosen for exactly the same reason it's hard to replace. Xylene is a fantastic solvent for plastics. It doesn't just sit on the surface, it partially dissolves it. That's how you get the pigment to bond. On polypropylene, polyethylene, the kinds of plastics that reject everything, xylene markers bite in and stay put. The chemistry is elegant, in a slightly terrifying way. Think of it like this. Most solvents are like rain on a windshield. They bead up and roll off. Xylene is more like acetone on styrofoam. It melts its way in, creates a microscopic well between the pigment and the plastic, and then evaporates, leaving the bond intact. That's why it's so hard to replace. You're not just looking for something that dries. You're looking for something that performs a controlled chemical attack on the surface.
Slightly terrifying being the operative phrase. Xylene's a recognized neurotoxin. OSHA's permissible exposure limit is 100 parts per million, averaged over 8 hours. And the American Conference of Governmental Industrial Hygienists, which is somehow a real organization, and not something I just made up, recommends 20 parts per million. That's a five-fold gap between what's legal and what's considered actually safe. And I want to sit with that gap for a second, because it's not just a trivia point. That 100 parts per million OSHA limit was set in 1971. It hasn't been updated in over 50 years. The ACGIH number, the 20 parts per million, that's based on studies from the 90s and 2000s showing neurological effects at much lower exposures than anyone thought possible in the 70s. So the legal limit is frozen in time, and the science has kept moving.
Here's the thing about those numbers. They're for workplace exposure, the kind of environment where someone's using these markers 8, 10, 12 hours a day. The neurotoxicity has been documented since the 1980s. Headaches, dizziness, cognitive impairment, longer-term nervous system damage. But for decades, the trade-off was considered acceptable because there simply wasn't a replacement that worked as well on non-porous surfaces. The logic was brutal but straightforward. We need this chemistry to make things work, and the people bearing the risk are the workers on the line, not the consumers buying the finished product.
Which brings us to the labeling paradox Daniel flagged. Walk through that.
It's almost elegant in its dishonesty. Xylene-free has become a marketing requirement. Every brand wants that on their label. So the ones who actually still use xylene, they just don't list it. The silence is the signal. If you pick up a marker and it doesn't say xylene-free anywhere, not on the front, not on the back, not in the fine print, that's your clue. And the psychology here is worth pausing on. Companies know that consumers scan for positive claims. Non-toxic, low odor, xylene-free, these jump out. What almost no one does is scan for the absence of a claim. It's a dark pattern in physical product labeling, and it's completely legal.
The dog that didn't bark.
And it works because most people don't think to look for the absence of a claim. They see a clean label and assume everything's fine. The practical tip here is genuinely useful. No xylene-free badge means you should probably pull up the safety data sheet online before you use it in an enclosed space. And I mean actually pull it up, not just glance at the front of the bottle. The front of the bottle is a marketing document. The SDS is a regulatory document. They serve different masters.
The Edding 750 Daniels now evangelizing for what's actually in that thing.
Lacquer-based formulation. Typically ethyl acetate, butyl acetate, and a toluene substitute. So they've swapped one aromatic hydrocarbon for something with a lower toxicity profile. The acetates are esters. They still evaporate. They're still volatile organic compounds, but they don't carry the same neurotoxicity concerns. And the lacquer base achieves that same plastic biting adhesion without needing to partially dissolve the surface. The way it works is actually clever. Instead of melting the plastic, the lacquer forms a film that mechanically locks onto the microscopic texture of the surface. It's adhesion through physical interlocking rather than chemical welding. Slightly less aggressive bond, but in most applications, more than good enough.
It's not that the replacement chemistry is simple or harmless. It's that it's less harmful in ways we can measure, which is a much less satisfying marketing claim than xylene-free, with a little green leaf icon. Less harmful in ways we can measure doesn't fit on a sticker.
And that's the tension that runs through this entire regulatory story. Xylene-free sounds like safe. But the replacement might be cyclohexanone, which is a suspected carcinogen, IARC group 2B. Or it might be N-propyl acetate, which is much less concerning but doesn't perform quite as well. The label doesn't tell you which trade-off was made. You have to go looking. And this is the fundamental problem with negative claims in chemical labeling. Free from X tells you exactly one thing. X is not in this product. It tells you nothing about YZ or anything else that might be in there. It's a silhouette of safety, not a portrait.
The Edding 750 represents the industry figuring out a path that actually works. Decent adhesion, lower toxicity, no xylene. But it took decades to get here, and the regulatory machinery that forced the change is worth understanding on its own terms. How did we actually get from xylene and everything to xylene being phased out?
Tracing that regulatory arc is instructive, because the gap between knowing xylene was a problem and actually doing something about it is instructive and depressing, if I'm being honest.
Depressing but instructive is basically the theme of every regulatory story we've ever told on this show.
The starting point is benzene. Benzene was the go-to industrial solvent for decades. Paints, adhesives, degreasers, you name it. Then the epidemiological data came in, leukemia. Elevated rates in workers exposed even at what were then considered safe levels. The EPI banned it from consumer products in 1978. That was the first major shot in what became a 50-year war on solvent toxicity. And the benzene story is worth remembering because it established the template. Industry said a ban would destroy manufacturing, said there were no alternatives, said the science was inconclusive. And then the ban happened, and within 3 years, alternative formulations appeared that nobody had been willing to invest in while benzene was still legal.
The pattern that gets established with benzene repeats with everything that comes after. Industry fights the ban, says there's no replacement, says the science isn't settled. And then the ban happens, and miraculously replacements appear within a few years. It's like clockwork. The innovation was always possible. It just wasn't profitable until the regulation forced it.
Every single time. After benzene came the chlorinated solvents, 1001 trichloroethane carbon tetrachloride. These were the workhorses of the adhesives and coatings industry through the 1980s, but they were shredding the ozone layer. The Montreal Protocol in 1987 put them on a phase-out schedule, and by 1996 they were effectively gone from consumer products in most developed countries. And here's the thing, the replacements for those chlorinated solvents? Some of them were actually worse on worker toxicity, just better on the ozone. So you fixed the global atmospheric problem and created a local respiratory problem. The trade-off was real, and it wasn't always a clear win.
By the time we get to xylene, the playbook is well established. But xylene slipped through for a long time because it wasn't as acutely dangerous as benzene, and it didn't destroy the ozone layer. It was just quietly neurotoxic. It didn't have a dramatic, headline-grabbing harm profile. It just slowly damaged the nervous systems of people who worked with it every day.
That's a good way to put it. The neurotoxicity was documented in occupational studies in the 1980s. Chronic exposure linked to cognitive deficits, memory problems, headaches that wouldn't quit. But the EPA's 1990 Clean Air Act listed xylene as a hazardous air pollutant, not a banned substance. That distinction matters. Hazardous air pollutant means you have to control emissions from factories. It doesn't mean you can't sell it in a marker. So you get scrubbers on the smokestacks, but the same chemical is still in a handheld applicator that someone's using at a workbench with no ventilation controls at all.
The factory has scrubbers and ventilation requirements, but the guy in a frame shop using it 8 hours a day, which Daniel mentioned doing during his summers, gets no protection from that regulation. The regulation is designed for the smokestack, not the workbench, and the workbench is where the actual exposure is happening.
That's the gap between emissions regulation and product regulation, and it's a gap that persists for decades. The EU finally started restricting xylene in consumer products under REH in 2018. That's registration, evaluation, authorization, and restriction of chemicals. REH is the big one. It doesn't just set exposure limits. It says, if you want to sell a chemical in the EU, you have to prove it's safe. The burden of proof shifts to the manufacturer, and that shift is everything. Under the old model, regulators had to prove harm. Under REACH, manufacturers have to prove safety. It inverts the entire incentive structure.
Which is the opposite of how the US system works or doesn't work.
In the US, under TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act, the EPA has to prove a chemical is dangerous before it can restrict it. That's a much higher bar. The 2016 Lautenberg Act updated TSCA to give the EPA more authority, but is still reactive rather than precautionary. The EU approach says, prove safety first. The US approach says, we'll get around to proving danger eventually. And the practical consequence is that the EU becomes the de facto regulator for the global market, because if you want to sell in Europe, you have to meet their standards, and it's often cheaper to just make one compliant version for everyone than to maintain separate product lines.
Eventually turns out to be measured in decades. Xylene neurotoxicity, documented 1980s. REACH restrictions begin, 2018. Full phase out, 2025. That's a 35 to 40 year gap.
In that gap, millions of markers were manufactured, sold, and used. Factory workers in countries with weaker labor protections. There was a University of Gothenburg study in 2025 that tested workers in Chinese marker factories. Urinary hippuric acid levels 3 times above background, which is a direct biomarker for xylene exposure. And these were factories producing markers labeled xylene-free for export. Let that sink in. The label on the finished product said one thing. The workers' bodies said another. The regulation changed the ink formulation that went into the marker. It didn't change the solvents used in the production process itself.
Of course they were.
The label said one thing. The workers' bodies said another.
The regulation finally catches up, the phase out happens, and now we're in the replacement era, and the replacement chemistry, the lacquer-based stuff in the Edding 750 is better on neurotoxicity. But it's not a magic solution. What are the actual trade-offs we're making now?
No, and this is where the trade-offs get real. Lacquer-based markers use esters, ethyl acetate, butyl acetate. These are volatile organic compounds. They still off-gas. The toxicity profile is lower, but if you're in a poorly ventilated space using them heavily, you're still breathing solvent vapors. The difference is the vapors aren't attacking your nervous system the way xylene does. Ethyl acetate, for context, is actually produced naturally by yeast during fermentation. It's one of the compounds that gives wine its fruity aroma. That doesn't mean you want to huff it by the gallon, but it does mean your body has metabolic pathways to break it down that it doesn't have for aromatic hydrocarbons like xylene.
Then there's the water-based option, which sounds like the obvious clean solution. Water-based markers, what's the catch?
The catch is plastics. Water-based formulations sit on top of polypropylene, polyethylene, HDPE. They don't bond. The water evaporates, the pigment dries, and then you touch it and it flakes right off. To get water-based markers to work on plastics, you need surface treatment, corona discharge, plasma treatment, chemical primers. That's fine for an industrial production line. It's useless for someone labeling storage bins in their apartment. The fundamental problem is that water has high surface tension and plastics have low surface energy. They fundamentally don't want to interact. It's like trying to write on a waxed car with a wet paintbrush. The liquid just beads up and retreats.
The trade-off matrix is, xylene markers work great on plastics, but are neurotoxic. Lacquer markers work well on plastics with lower toxicity, but still emit VOCs. Water-based markers are the safest, but fail on the most common plastics, unless you're running a plasma treater in your garage.
Which most people are not.
I don't know. Daniel seems like the kind of person who might.
But for normal humans, the lacquer-based option is the current sweet spot. And Edding has leaned into this hard. Their catalog, which is 240 pages, and yes, I also downloaded it, because apparently this is who I am now. Their catalog shows only one marker in their entire industrial line that still uses xylene. That's the Edding 800, and it's specifically for extreme conditions. Galvanized steel, surfaces that are going to face chemical exposure or extreme heat. It's the marker of last resort. They're not pretending xylene has no legitimate uses. They're saying, here's the one application where nothing else works, and here's the marker for it, and for everything else, we have a safer option.
Their 2025 annual report states that 92% of their ink formulations are now xylene-free, with a target of 100% by 2028. That's a company that's not just responding to regulation. They're getting ahead of it. They're treating the phase-out as a competitive advantage rather than a compliance cost.
Which is smart business, because the regulatory wave is not slowing down. The EU's Chemical Strategy for Sustainability is aiming to ban all most harmful chemicals in consumer products by 2030. That's going to sweep in a lot more than xylene. And California's Proposition 65 listed xylene as a reproductive toxin in 2021, which means warning labels, which means retailers don't want it on shelves. No big box store wants a product sitting in the aisle with a sticker that says known to the state of California to cause reproductive harm. That's a sales killer. So even without a federal ban, the retail channel starts squeezing xylene out just to avoid the Prop 65 headache.
The market and the regulators are finally aligned after 40 years of misalignment. But I want to connect this to the bigger picture, because markers are just one tiny corner of the solvent and adhesive universe. The same story is playing out in industrial tape, in paint, in food packaging coatings, in the stuff that lines your canned goods. And the history there is arguably even uglier, and no case brings that home more sharply than Teflon.
The Teflon story is the one that really crystallizes this. DuPont knew about PFOA toxicity in the 1980s. Internal documents, animal studies showing liver damage, birth defects. They kept manufacturing it for another 30 years. The community around the Parkersburg, West Virginia plant, elevated cancer rates, contaminated water supply, and it took a class action lawsuit and a feature film decades later before anything changed. And the mechanism there is worth understanding, because it's the same mechanism that plays out with xylene and every other industrial chemical. The harm is slow, diffuse, and hard to trace to a specific source. A worker gets headaches for years, then cognitive problems, then retires early, and nobody connects the dots back to the marker solvent because the latency is so long and the causation is so hard to prove in an individual case.
Rob Billett, the lawyer who broke that case open, he's still litigating PFAS cases. The Dark Waters story didn't end with the credits. PFAS is the new benzene in terms of scale. It's in everything, non-stick pans, waterproof jackets, food packaging, and crucially for our discussion, adhesives and coatings. The reason PFAS shows up in so many places is that the carbon-fluorine bond is one of the strongest in organic chemistry. It's incredibly stable. That's the feature. And also the bug, because that stability means it never breaks down in the environment.
Which is why 3M's 2022 announcement to stop PFAS production by the end of 2025 is such a big deal. 3M basically invented the PFAS market. Scotchgard, the stuff that made your couch stain-resistant, that was PFAS chemistry. And when they announced the phase-out, it sent a shockwave through the entire adhesives and coatings supply chain. Every manufacturer that relied on PFAS-based formulations suddenly needed a Plan B.
The Plan Bs are what?
Two main paths. Silicone-based alternatives. These use siloxane chemistry to achieve similar water and stain resistance. But siloxanes have their own problems. The cyclic siloxanes, D4 and D5 specifically, are suspected endocrine disruptors. The EU already restricts D4 in wash-off cosmetics. There's a real possibility that in 5 years we'll be having this exact same conversation about siloxanes that we're having about PFAS today. The cycle just keeps turning.
The regrettable substitution loop.
That's the technical term for it, actually. You ban chemical A, the industry moves to chemical B, and 10 years later you discover chemical B is just as bad or worse. The classic example from the solvent world. When xylene started getting regulatory pressure, some manufacturers simply switched to toluene. Toluene is also neurotoxic. It's slightly less aggressive on plastics adhesion, but the health profile is not meaningfully better. So the upgrade was basically a lateral move in terms of worker safety, dressed up as progress.
The xylene-free label on a marker made in 2020 could mean they just swapped one aromatic hydrocarbon for another and called it a day. The consumer sees progress. The chemist sees a shell game.
And that's the point the listener needs to internalize. Free from X doesn't mean safe. It means free from X. The replacement is a separate question, and it's a question the label almost never answers.
There's a specific example from the marker world that makes this concrete. Some manufacturers, when they drop xylene, move to cyclohexanone as the solvent. Cyclohexanone is classified by the IARC as Group 2B, possibly carcinogenic to humans. So you've traded a known neurotoxin for a suspected carcinogen. Is that better? Maybe, depending on exposure levels and the specific risks you're weighing. But it's certainly not the clean green story the packaging implies. You're not eliminating risk. You're swapping one risk profile for another, and the consumer has no way to evaluate whether that's a good trade.
That's where certification bodies become useful, because they do the homework that the average consumer can't. The EU Ecolabel, Germany's Blue Angel, Cradle to Cradle, these aren't just marketing badges. They audit the entire chemical supply chain. Blue Angel, for example, requires full disclosure of all intentionally added substances above zero. You can't hide behind a xylene-free claim if a certifier is checking your formulation against a restricted substances list. The certifier becomes the proxy for the consumer's due diligence.
Edding publishes their restricted substances list publicly. You can download it alongside that glorious 240-page catalog. It names every substance they've committed to phasing out, with timelines. That level of transparency is rare, and it's worth rewarding with your purchasing decisions. When a company says, here's exactly what we're removing and when, they're making themselves accountable in a way that's verifiable. Most companies won't do that because it creates a paper trail of commitments they might not keep.
It matters because the next wave of regulation is already on the horizon. The EU's restriction on intentionally added microplastics, that takes full effect in 2028 to 2028. This sounds like it's about glitter and face scrubs, but it reaches into the marker industry too. Some pigments used in paint markers are microplastic particles by definition. Certain metallic and pearlescent effects rely on plastic-based pigment carriers. That shimmer in your gold paint marker could be tiny plastic spheres coated with metal oxides. Under the new rules, those are microplastics, and they're on the chopping block.
The EU is coming for the glitter markers.
And Edding's response is instructive. They're developing bio-based solvents from corn fermentation, ethyl lactate derived from agricultural feedstocks. They're also moving toward recycled plastic barrels. The R&D pipeline is aiming for a marker that's carbon negative when paired with renewable energy at the production facility. So you've got a solvent made from fermented plant sugar in a barrel made from recycled plastic, applying pigment that doesn't rely on microplastic carriers. That's the vision.
The marker of 2030 might be made from fermented corn, solubilized in a biosolvent, housed in recycled plastic, adhering to surfaces without neurotoxins or carcinogens. And it'll cost about twice what a Sharpie costs today. The question is whether consumers will pay that premium, or whether the regulation just has to make the cheap option illegal. Because if the safer marker is on the shelf at $6 and the neurotoxic one is at $3, a lot of people are going to reach for the $3 option and not think twice.
That's the fault line in the whole regulatory debate. The U.S. approach, even with the 2024 Lautenberg Act updates accelerating TSCA risk evaluations, still defaults to letting the market sort it out. The EU approach says the market won't sort it out because the externalities are invisible. A factory worker's neurological damage doesn't show up on the price tag of a marker. The cost is real, but it's borne by someone who isn't the buyer, in a country that isn't the market, on a timeline that's longer than the quarterly earnings report. That's the textbook definition of an externality, and markets are terrible at pricing externalities.
The Gothenburg study proves it. Workers in Chinese factories making xylene-free markers for the European market, with urinary biomarkers showing xylene exposure 3 times background levels. The regulation forced the label to change. It didn't necessarily force the production process to change. The workers absorbed the cost of the gap between the two. The EU consumer got a safer product. The Chinese worker got the same exposure they always had. The externality didn't disappear. It just moved.
Which brings us back to the practical question for someone standing in a hardware store. How do you actually evaluate whether a green marker is safer? First step, look up the safety data sheet. The SDS lists every solvent above 1% concentration. Compare the LD50 values, that's the lethal dose for 50% of test subjects, across brands. Compare the VOC content. If the manufacturer doesn't make the SDS easily available online, that's a signal. And I mean a real signal. An SDS is required by law in most jurisdictions. If a company is making it hard to find, they're either disorganized or they're hiding something, and neither is a good look.
Second step, look for the certification logos. Blue Angel, EU Ecolabel, Cradle to Cradle. These aren't perfect. No certification system is, but they represent third-party verification that someone has checked the supply chain beyond the label claims. A xylene-free claim with no certification is just words. A Blue Angel certification means a lab has verified the formulation. There's a chain of accountability.
Third, match the marker to the actual job. If you're labeling cardboard boxes, use a water-based marker, no solvent exposure at all. If you need plastic adhesion, lacquer-based is currently the best balance of performance and safety. Edding 750, Unipaint PX21, these use ester solvents with lower neurotoxicity profiles. Save the true industrial xylene markers for the extreme edge cases where nothing else works, and use them with ventilation. The right tool for the right job, but also the right chemistry for the right risk profile.
The pattern here is bigger than markers. It's the same dynamic across the entire industrial chemistry landscape. PFAS in adhesives gets replaced by siloxanes, which turn out to be endocrine disruptors. Xylene gets replaced by cyclohexanone, which turns out to be a suspected carcinogen. Bisphenol A in plastics gets replaced by bisphenol S, which, surprise, has similar estrogenic activity. The whack-a-mole never stops because the incentive structure rewards finding the cheapest compliant replacement, not the safest one. And compliant just means not yet banned. It doesn't mean understood. What does that mean for you, standing in the aisle at the hardware store, trying to pick a marker that won't give you a headache? 3 things I'd actually do.
First, look up the safety data sheet. Every reputable manufacturer has SDS documents online. They list every solvent above 1% concentration. Compare the LD50 values across brands. That's the lethal dose for 50% of test subjects, a rough proxy for acute toxicity. Compare the VOC content. If the manufacturer doesn't make the SDS easy to find, that's a signal in itself.
Second, for plastic adhesion without xylene, lacquer-based markers are your friend. The Edding 750, Unipaint PX21. These use ester solvents that get the job done without the neurotoxicity baggage. And here's a trick. If you're stuck with water-based markers but need them to stick to plastic, wipe the surface with isopropyl alcohol first. Removes the mold release agents and gives the ink something to bite into. It's not as good as a true solvent bond, but it's better than watching your label flake off 2 days later.
Third, support the manufacturers who are actually transparent. Edding publishes their restricted substances list in full, every chemical they've committed to phasing out, with dates. Their target is all substances of very high concern gone by 2028. That's not marketing. That's a legal commitment you can verify. And verification matters because it creates a feedback loop. When consumers reward transparency with purchases, more companies become transparent. When transparency is ignored, it withers.
The meta point here is that regulation is moving faster than most people realize. What was acceptable in 2020 may be banned by 2027. The marker you bought 3 years ago might not be legal to sell next year. Paying attention now saves you from being the person who discovers their go-to product has been reformulated into uselessness with no warning.
It saves you from being the person who thought xylene-free meant safe when the replacement was cyclohexanone and you've been huffing a group 2B carcinogen in a poorly ventilated garage for 2 years. The label tells you what's not there. The SDS tells you what is.
We've covered a lot of ground, but there's one question that keeps me up at night, and it's the one nobody in the industry wants to answer. The EU's 2030 ban on most harmful chemicals in consumer products, is that going to create a unified global standard, or is it going to split the marker market in two? EU-compliant markers on one shelf, and the cheap stuff with the old chemistry sold everywhere else.
I think we're already seeing the split. The Gothenburg study essentially documented it. Factories making compliant labels for Europe, while the production floor itself ran on the old solvents. The regulation changes what's on the package. Whether it changes what's in the air, that depends on enforcement, and enforcement is wildly uneven. You can have the strictest laws in the world on paper, but if the factory inspector in one country is doing unannounced visits, and the inspector in another country is giving 3 weeks' notice, you have two completely different realities.
You get a two-tier world. The EU consumer breathes cleaner air in their garage, the factory worker doesn't, and the US sits somewhere in the middle, with OSHA maybe tightening rules by Q3, but no ban on the horizon. The regulatory patchwork creates winners and losers, and the losers are almost always the people with the least power to demand change.
The counterweight is that some manufacturers are betting the unified standard will win. Edding's R&D pipeline is instructive here. They're working on ethyl acetate derived from sugarcane fermentation. Bio-based solvent, agricultural waste feedstock. If you pair that with renewable energy at the production site, the entire marker becomes carbon negative. That's not compliance. That's leapfrogging the regulation entirely. They're not waiting to be told what to do. They're betting that the future of regulation is stricter, not looser, and they're building for that future now.
Corn stover, wood chips, sugarcane waste. These are the new oil wells for solvent chemistry. It's a weirdly hopeful note to end on. The same industrial chemistry that gave us benzene and xylene and PFAS is capable of giving us solvents made from fermented plant waste. The molecule doesn't care where the carbon came from. Ethyl acetate is ethyl acetate, whether it was cracked from petroleum or fermented from corn. But the supply chain, the worker safety profile, the environmental footprint, those are completely different stories.
The question for listeners is whether they'll reward that with their wallets. Check your marker drawer. Look up the SDS for whatever's in there. See what you've actually been breathing. Then decide if the bio-based lacquer marker is worth the extra $3.
It probably is. Your neurons will thank you.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The largest collection of Linear A inscriptions ever discovered in a single location was found not in Crete, but in French Guiana in 1687, when a shipment of Minoan artifacts bound for a private collector in Paris was seized by pirates and buried near Cayenne. The hoard contained 47 clay tablets and was lost again until 1923.
Right.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Check your SDS, and we'll see you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head,
send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.